Adventist World Radio, from broadcast to baptism, powered by SID Media.
Can you hear us, Mda?
I can hear you now.
Lovely.
I can hear you now.
Lovely. Yes. Lovely. All right. It appears now you're hearing me through another device there. I see there's two devices of mine logged on there. All right. We'll continue anyways, because we need to be able to have our conversation. Once again, good afternoon to you, Mdala. Thank you very much. I do apologize for all of the problems that we've been experiencing here. So let's get into, just give us a recap of what we left off talking about last week.
Okay, so last week we introduced the seven churches. The message is to the seven churches. Again, our understanding, based on what we're reading from the book of Revelation, is that these are seven successive stages of the church history, beginning in AD 31, all the way up until the second coming of Jesus Christ. So God is giving us events that will take place, but not only events, but the condition of the church throughout the seven epochs of time until his second coming. But we managed to link these churches with the seals. So for the first church, we could relate the first church to the second seal. That's touching on Revelation 4 and 5.
Right.
And again, being able to tie the two together, which was amazing. Because what we then discovered is that for every, whatever we study from a church perspective, there's added details when we look at the seals, and where there are not a lot of details in the seals. In fact, one of the things you see is that the seals have just a very concise summary of what is taking place. But the church seems to go more into detail around what is transpiring within the condition of the churches.
Okay.
So we looked at the church of Ephesus, which is the beginning church, the church of the apostles. From there, we looked at the church of Smyrna from AD 100 to around AD 313. And we then looked at the church of Pergamos, which we defined to be the church that was existing during the time when the church was at its seat of Satan. You remember we spoke about that.
We discussed that, yes.
Very tricky one. Yeah, so today we're kicking off from the church of Thyatira, and then moving towards the end of the chapter, looking at the church of Laodicea and seeing also what the seals could have in store for us in relation to whatever we'll be looking at. Yes.
All right. So
that's where we are.
Yeah. So I'm curious again, before we even get into that, remind us again the relationship between the church and the seal.
Okay. So the church and the seal, what we discovered last week is that God is discussing specifically conditions related to the churches,
right,
as we look at them in chapters 2 to 3 of the book of Revelation. And when we look at the seals, it's specific happenings around the world at that particular time. So the church focus between chapters 2 to 3 and the events of the world and added details when we look at the seals. And the interesting thing we discovered last week, no one else could open the seals except the one who had conquered.
Right.
And that being the Lamb representing Jesus Christ, because he had an experience of both. And we said anyone could have done it. Any of the angels could have done that. But it didn't mean no one could be able to do it. It's just that no one had the experience Christ had.
And
we also discussed that God did not necessarily need to have the experience, but because Jesus had been acquainted with our infirmities, it was easier for him to open the seals because he had conquered on our behalf. Yes.
Yeah, I remember there was an explanation that the pastor was talking about, Pastor Kavasa was talking about, which I was curious that you might perhaps give again. Because when we're saying he is acquainted with our infirmities, it implies that God the Spirit is not acquainted with our infirmities. God the Father is not acquainted with our infirmities, which disposes of the omniscience of God, which contradicts the entire theology of Christendom, that God is omniscient, and he was omniscient before he was a human being, before he was incarnate.
Yes.
So kindly clarify that before we continue, Mda.
Yeah, and we agree, because I guess the primary reason why we seem to lean towards that is simply because from a physical perspective, he endured everything from a physical perspective. And the other thing which the Bible seems to translate in a very interesting manner is that he had to deny godliness to put on humanity on our behalf. So there's that also dual role that he has to play, where he had to be part God and man at the same time. So who better to stand on our behalf than God? And symbolically, where he is now, he stands as not only our advocate, but someone who we can look up to.
Before he was incarnate, does it mean that God didn't know or does not know, or at the time, he was not acquainted with our infirmities?
Well, the acquaintance there was there from him being God, but from a physical perspective where he needs to put on humanity, that was not present at that point.
So God doesn't know everything.
That's the argument. Well, he does not know sin. He's never committed sin. Yes, so that could be an argument for...
But is that your argument that God is not omniscient?
We know he is. I mean, that's a biblical definition of what God is. But God does not know sin by experience. So he does not necessarily need to commit sin for him to know it.
So the very concept of omniscience, Elder, is all-knowing, knowing some.
Yes.
So when you're saying he doesn't know some things, then you're effectively nullifying omniscience.
Okay, so he knows it. He's seen it. But he does not need to commit it physically to be able to. Yes, and that's the separation. So the actual physical experience of what we are going through is not necessarily his. Yeah, could be argued though. I hear where you're coming from.
Okay, let's move on. Let's move on, Mdala. We're dealing with chapter 2 and chapter 3.
It's actually a very good point. Could we then say he also needs to know everything? Do we say knowledge is, do we separate physical? Yeah.
Well, you have just done that, Pastor. You have just separated physical knowledge from theoretical knowledge.
I've not denied that he's all knowing. I've just said he has not physically gone through what we have gone through.
Yeah, so
that's my suggestion.
That he has no physical knowledge implies he doesn't have all knowledge. For omni implies in no. place that all. Omni is all, isn't it, Elder?
Yeah, it's true.
So all he doesn't all. Know yes, all. Not, According to your theory, not, he does not know all.
He knows all. That's not what I said. He knows all, yes.
But he doesn't know. Through it. He doesn't know
through
the experience.
Physical experience? Yeah, no, he has not gone through, the physical. I think when the Bible says he's not acquainted with our infirmities, that means he was acquainted with our... It speaks of him, yes. And the focus is on him because he's dealt with us, he's lived with us, he's suffered what we suffer, he's grown hungry, he's thirsted, so the physical things we go through as humanity, he's gone through. God, not necessarily so in the physical sense. God the Father, not in the physical sense, yes, and that's what we are implying. Not necessarily that he's not knowing, he does not need to experience not to know, but he knows because he's God. Maybe let's leave it there,
Mdala. Let's move on. Let's go to Sardis. Let's go to chapter 3.
Tytara.
I don't believe. Let's go to Tytara. That's verse 8. Go ahead. Verse 18, rather. Go ahead, Mdala. Introduce us to Tytara.
So because of the lack of time, I won't go through the verses, but I'll just give a brief summary around the churches. And here we're looking at a church from around 538 to around the 1500s. So in comparison with the other cities, Tytara had no political or cultural significance that we know of. But the church in itself was like obscure. It had, in order to run a business or a job, the people in the Roman Empire at that time had to belong to what we call trade guilds. So Tyatira was especially known for its enforcing this requirement. So you had to go through this in order to get. So guild members had to attend the guild festivals and participate in temple rituals, and which often included some immoral activities. And those who did not comply then faced exclusion from the guilds and economic sanctions. So the idea is that Christians at this time meant choosing between total compromise from the previous church which we went from to total exclusion for the sake of the gospel. And so you have a church that is now, God is not particularly happy with this church because now it has seemingly accepted a lot of the teachings of the sort of compromising era, which came from what we discussed the last time. So God introduces a name by the name of Jezebel. So we see the name of Jezebel. If you remember Jezebel, back in the book of 1 Kings chapter 16, she was the wife of Ahab, who then led Israel into apostasy.
Right.
So Jesus portrays Jezebel as spiritual immorality. So those church members who compromise the truth are then adopted unclean pagan ideas and practices are committing spiritual adultery with her. So we have a church that is in its Jezebel state, where tradition has replaced the Bible and human priesthood and sacred relics. You have the introduction of indulgences and it's no longer the salvation by grace, it's salvation by works, where you had to buy an indulgence to free your grandmother who was stuck in purgatory to another place, and only to use that money to build the cathedrals, for instance, St. Peter's cathedrals and so on. So you have people selling indulgences in the place of a genuine relationship with Christ. And then people started fleeing away from the Roman environment at that time, and started fleeing to mountains and so on. So you start seeing the presence of the Waldensians and all the other reformers starting to come up during that time period. But something very interesting, it's called Tietera. Not only that, but by the way, the word Tietera means perfume or labor or sweet savor or sacrifice, because a lot of these Christians who then denied the faith that was present at the time were then either thrust into prison or even killed for the faith. But that's why God, in his compliment for the church, applauds them for their good works, love, patience, particularly patience, because they had to, you know, survive during a time which was very, very tough. But I want to read something in this very experience.
Forgive me, Elder, before you move on there, you've given me some definitions that I need some clarity on. We have Jezebel. What did you say Jezebel was about and what she represents?
Okay, so Jezebel, if you remember in the book of 1 Kings, so you had Israel who worshiped the true God, and the introduction of Jezebel, who then forced the arm of his husband to seduce Israel into worshiping the gods of Baal. Okay. If you remember, there was this whole issue with where Isaiah had to, not Isaiah,
Elijah,
where you had Elijah had to come in and eventually slay the prophets of Baal. So here the idea is around worship.
To do what?
No. So the idea of the symbols within Revelation, the idea of Jezebel or the portrayal of Jezebel here brings forth the idea of worship. And that's what we're linking worship with in this case.
Yeah.
And when you study the events at the time, you would see that it's exactly what we are talking about here, where you have paganistic ideas coming into the church and becoming practiced predominantly in the church, where the only Bible that was available was a Latin version of the Bible, no translation in the other for the other people. So people could not read the Bible for themselves. And so the priests themselves could dictate what needs to be done from a faith-based idea or system or culture, whatever you may call it. So we see tradition coming into play, the introduction of all these other experiences and relics and so on that come into the church at that time.
Yeah. All right. So and then the meaning of the word Tietera. Just explain that and how it comes into play here, because you gave the perfume sacrifice of labor definition, which I was hoping you'd relate to what we're talking about now.
Okay. So yeah, very nice. So in the sanctuary, you had in the first apartment the altar of burnt incense. In fact, maybe let's go back even way before that. The book of Genesis, you have the two sons of Adam who had to offer to God a sacrifice that would be a sweet smelling savor unto him. So that's where the idea that where there is a sacrifice, a true sacrifice representing true worship, and the idea where God dictates how we worship him, that becomes an acceptable sacrifice to him. So the idea of Tietera here is that you have present in the church individuals who were not willing to compromise, particularly the faith, who stood the test of time without fear of opposition or death or whatsoever. And so their death ultimately became the sweet-smelling savor in terms of their sacrifice for their faith. So them standing there and saying, yeah, bring on the flames. We are willing to die for the faith. Yeah.
Right.
And so it becomes a sweet smelling sacrifice.
Right.
On their side. Yeah.
Okay.
So God introduces an element of judgment, which is going to link up very nicely with the seal here, the fourth seal that we're looking into when we get to the book of Revelation chapter five is the fact that in verse 23, God says, now, because all of this is happening, I will kill her children with death, and all the churches shall know that I am he that searcheth the reins of the heart, and I will go unto every one of you according to your works. So where we are now is actually termed the Dark Ages period in Europe. So you had the big plague that struck Europe at that time. And again, from this depiction, we are able to check that this was actually the judgment of God for what he was seeing taking place within those who called themselves.
So which plague was this?
He's chosen. That was the Black Plague, if I'm not mistaken, that took place in Europe.
Okay.
During the time, it was called the Dark Ages, particularly because it was a dark time of not only faith, but a lot of people died in Europe during that time, if you remember historically. And they died from the plague that struck the whole of Europe at that time. I'm just forgetting the dates and time periods. But how we then link that up with the book of Revelation, and particularly the seals, is if you go to chapter...
So but why is you still paging there, yes. Dala? When you're talking about the Black Plague, allegedly, when you remember into history, there were three different waves in which it came. So which one would you be referring to? Or is it all three waves of the Black Plague? Which era are you referring to?
Okay, so any single ones that would transpire between this time period we are talking to. So from 538 up until the beginning of the 15th century, around 15 to up until 1565. I think we started seeing the end of the plague around the 1565s or 1550s. That's after the beginning of the formal reformation. Yes, the idea of the reformation. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's where we're picking it up from.
Okay.
But the other important thing here, maybe let's go back to around good works, maybe talk about that before we get to the seal, is that God acknowledges the good works of the faithful ones at that time. You know, God was not silent. There were still individuals who were paramount in standing against the abuses of Rome.
We know
the likes of Tyndale. We know the likes of Martin Luther and all his other friends who stood for the truth, even during a period such as this, who wanted to proclaim that, you know, the just shall live by faith and by faith alone, no need to pay indulgences and bow down to these relics and whatever else was portrayed at that time. And so that brought back the love for God, and particularly with the other works that you find taking place there is the conversion of the Bible into the language of the people, and slowly people started to read God's word and become acquainted with the truth as it is found in his word. Okay.
Just chew on a few things there, Mdal. Verse 20.
Yes.
Says, nevertheless, I have this against you. You tolerate that woman, Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess.
Yes.
I'm worried there, Pastor. Mdala.
Worried about?
That woman who calls it. Surely there is no... The institution that we're referring to here never called themselves a prophetess. They have never called themselves prophets, quite frankly. None of their saints, quote unquote, have ever alleged to be prophets. Quite frankly, they call themselves those who are sitting in the seat of Peter, not prophets.
Yeah, so they stand in the place of Peter. Yeah, well, maybe the other idea which we need to bring forth here, first of all, on the concept of prophecy or profiting.
Right.
So there's two different things we need to know. Sometimes by preaching in the Bible, the word is used interchangeably. So preaching could be a form of
prophesying.
Prophecy, yes. Yeah, prophesying through words and through God's word. Yes, right. Prophesying. And there could be the literal form of prophets. If there's a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make them known unto you.
Right.
So here's a very interesting thing. The institution we have spoken about in the past weeks, we are looking at an institution that says, we stand in the place of God Almighty here on earth. They call themselves, the head of the church calls himself the vicar of Christ, the one who stands in his place. And therefore,
not the vicar of Christ, but the vicar of the Son of God. Vicarious
Filii Dei. Of Christ. Yeah, vicarious Filii Dei means the vicar of the Son of God, which is the vicar of Christ. Yeah, in this case, or one who's in, when the Bible calls it Antichrist, when the Bible refers to one that says Antichrist, it means in the place of. So replacing the one who should be there, in this case being Christ. So the one who stands in the place of Christ. So Christ was a prophet? Yes. In all respects. He's even termed a prophet. So Christ in his everyday life was attributed to one. He spoke as a prophet. Yeah. The authority he had, he spoke as a prophet. So here we're not looking at a prophet physically. But we're looking at the idea of them having authority to impose certain requirements, particularly from a church perspective. If you remember what we spoke about earlier, there was a requirement, particularly in the guilds. The history narrative there is very important because they had to enforce, ultimately also including immoral activities to be conducted within those particular.
Just clarify guilds, the part of the gender there. Here it is specifically feminized. And yet we know in the institution we were referring to, there is no feminine participation whatsoever. Quite frankly, God appears to be objecting to that feminine being there, or in your interpretation, feminine institution, again, which does not apply to the institution we're referring to. They are quite anti-feminist.
It's true. And in the Bible, all throughout the Bible, especially in prophecy, we understand, or in fact, when God speaks about his church or Israel as his people, he would always term or use the term women or the feminine side of. For instance, Revelation chapter 12says, there appeared a wonder in heaven, verses 1, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and upon her the 12 tribes.
No, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that part. What I'm asking about, Mdala, is God has something against this institution of that has a gender that is feminine.
Yes.
So he's not against the church. The church is feminine, I understand. She has played the harlot and the wife to Christ. I understand all of that. But here, God seems to be objecting to an institution that is also feminine. And so what I'm trying to establish... Go ahead.
It's his church right there, you know?
The one that he's against?
Church, the only... Yes, he's against his church. He's not happy with the practice of his church. You must remember at that time, the predominant church at that time was the Church of Rome.
No, there was no other
institution.
My question was on verse 20. Yes. Nevertheless, I have this against you. 20. You tolerate the woman Jezebel. So the church tolerates the woman Jezebel who pretends to be a prophet.
True, yes.
So my issue is not about the church. So, it's about what the church is tolerating. The woman Jezebel.
Yes, they're tolerating. Yeah, they're tolerating the system. Yes, you're correct. Very there.
Right.
So the church in itself is tolerating the woman there, or the institution that is encouraging these practices, which are not necessarily biblical.
Hence my question, why is that institution feminized?
Because it also represents itself as a church. You must remember it's both a political power and a religious power. So both combined.
Got it. Continue. Done. I hear you.
100%. So we are looking at this church, and God has a promise that he who overcomes and keeps his works until the end, to him will I give power over the nations.
Okay.
So a very powerful reminder that there's always the element of conquering, you know, overcoming, and God has a reward for his faithfulness. Now we dive quickly to the book of Revelation, and we go to Revelation chapter 6, and we look at the fourth seal. And verses 7 says, And when he had opened the fourth seal, and I heard the voice of the fourth beast, don't ask me about beasts today, come and see. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And the reason why it's called the pale horse, if you look at all the other horses, number one, we talk about death here. We're talking about the black plague. We're also talking about, you know, when you look at the church in itself, it has become feebled and feebled by obscure practices and so on, but let's continue to read. And his name that sat on him was death. Again, you remember we spoke about death earlier and the black plague, and hell followed with him. The power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth to kill with the sword and with hunger and with death and with the beasts of the earth. So you had turmoil all across Europe during that time. We all know what it went through, what people went through. It, you know, they couldn't even provide for themselves. So economic sanctions that were spoke about earlier, a failure to uphold Roman tyranny and so on. So people were then thrust into all these hectic punishments because they would not uphold Roman tyranny. Okay. Seeing time, I want to jump into the Church of Sardis unless you have a question.
No. We can continue. We're okay, I'm done.
Okay. All right, so we're looking at the Church of Sardis, if you can call it, unto the Church of the Angel in Sardis, right? These things said, he that hath the seven spirits of God and the seven stars, I know thy works, that thou hast a name. Very important, I want to read this one because it sort of hits me hard. You have a name that thou livest, but art dead, you know? And there's almost eventually, immediately after that, a sort of an admonition, verse 2, be watchful, strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found thy works to be perfect before God. This is one of the few churches where God does not have a lot of good things to say about them, you know? And so Sardis here is one of those churches. So Sardis is from around the 1500s all the way to the 1790s. These are those that the name Sardis means those escaping or remaining. They are compliant literally because of their dead works. So God is not happy with them because they are compliant. And I'll explain why that is the issue.
Compliant.
Yes, I'll explain that.
Okay.
Why we're saying they're compliant. And then there's a promise of white raiment. So I'll go into it as I take you through the history. So Sardis here has a glorious history, but by the Roman period, the city had lost its prestige. While the city was still enjoying wealth and so on, its glory had been rooted in past history rather than present reality. I hope that point is very clear. So you're looking at a church which had a glorious history, and this is something we want to pick out from the story around Sardis. It was rooted in its past history and rather than its, you know, the constant reminder, we used to be, so the emphasis of historicism, yes, versus present reality.
We are a reading church here.
We were.
This is not our music now.
So it lost its present realities and how to,
right,
you know, still enforce godliness within this present reality.
Right.
So the ancient city had been built on top of a very steep hill and was nearly thought to be impregnable, you know, because the citizens felt so secure, the city was well guarded, and people thought they were safe, you know, because of that. And here comes in the idea that you have a church that came from a Reformation period. Mm. You know, you had people there who John Knox, Calvinized. So you have all these the full strength of the Protestant Reformation, the splittings of this church. You have the Lutherans, you have the Calvins, you had, and so on. So everyone is now basically separated from Rome because they had protested against Rome. You know, since the nailing of the 95 Theses on the door of Wittenberg in 1531 by Martin Luther, so all these others began to see the truth and began to flee from the mother church at that time, which was called the Roman Catholic Church. And so in their dispersion, they are finding peace, settled on this, what we term to be the steep hill, sitting there and finding comfort in the fact that now that we've left Rome, we can then chill. There's no longer any reason for us to protest. Therefore, there's a sense of comfortability. And with that comes the church then steeped into a degenerated form of life, of lifeless formalism and a state of spiritual complacency.
What does that mean, Umdad?
And under the impact of a rising tide of like rationalism and secularism, the church is
what does that mean? What does lifeless formalism mean?
And the message of God became very dry and so on. So you can sense that we are here, we are happy now, we've gone out of that. But unfortunately, it's still not dealing with the present realities of what the Christian church was going through there. And so God is not pleased with them. And it says, remember,
sorry, Mdalo.
Verses 3 says, yes.
You used a phrase that I'm not sure I understand. You said lifeless formalism. Can't clarify that. What do you mean by that?
Okay. So there is a danger. And by the way, one time when we have time, we need to speak about this.
Okay.
There is a danger in, and this is where it's very important for people to understand. It's very easy to find yourself on the extreme of the faith in either side.
Okay.
You can be very formal to a degree where even God's presence does not do the guiding or the leading anymore, because you are struck in order and movements and so on. So it's almost like the Pharisees type of thing. So it's very lifeless in the sense that even when you walk around, you greet this elder in the church, hey, don't talk to me, I'm in the spirit on the Lord's day, that type of behavior. So very cold and lifeless in terms of formalism. Elder can't even smile at church. We can't even, it's that dead formalism. And the other side is where you can be on the complete end of the stick, where we worship God based on how we feel. So feelings are the basis of faith and not necessarily God's principles or his word.
Okay.
And so one could fall on either side. And we call it lifeless because it's dead. Imagine being in the church where everything is just you smile, hey.
All right.
So all right. Continue.
Continue, Mdala. Are we going to Philadelphia?
We're going to go there. So remember, maybe let me finish this one. So remember, therefore, how thou hast received and heard, and hold fast and repent. So remember the old, but then hold fast now and do something about your present situation. Okay, so I'm just going to rush because of time. I see we are quite behind. So then comes the church of Philadelphia.
Right.
Now, this is the sixth church addressed by Jesus. Was Philadelphia by meaning means brotherly love, and here we're looking at a church that existed from 1790 to around the 1840s. So the meaning of the name is brotherly love. The complaint God has is just that the fact that they have little strength. The compliment is they've kept God's word and not denied him. And by doing that, the promise is that they will be kept from the hour of trial, and they'll be a pillar in God's temple, and they'll even bear the name of God.
Right.
So the sixth church addressed by Jesus was Philadelphia, meaning brotherly love. Like I said, the city was located on an imperial trade road, served as a gateway, and hence the term open door. If you read the text, you'll see that God talks about an open door to a large and fertile sort of land there. So excavations indicated that Philadelphia was a center to which people came for health and healing,
right?
And eventually was shaken by frequent earthquakes. However, the people then left to the countryside and so on. So the message for this church is prophetically to the great revival of Protestantism during the first and second Advent awakening that took place in the greater part of Great Britain all the way to America from around the 1740s to 1844. So we have the idea of the open door there, the closed door and the open door that no man can shut. And so you have the idea of the two apartments in the sanctuary, because Revelation 4 starts off, verses 1 and 2 starts off with the open door. Behold, there's an open door and so on. So there's entry into a door, Christ leading into the most holy part of the temple from around 1844. When we went into that study, if you remember Daniel 7, so we have the idea that here we are looking at the church that existed during the Millerite movement, and not only that, but the Great Advent Awakening, which went all the way from Britain to America. So you have the likes of Manuel Lacunza, you have the likes of Joseph Wolff, you have the likes of the Millerites who preached the gospel, even the child preachers of Sweden who at the time they had banished all the time prophecies. No one wanted to hear anything about time prophecies. But here were these little children who stood up from ages 7 to around 12, 6 to around 12, who stood on tables and proclaimed. Their message was, interestingly, fear God, for the hour of his judgment had come. And these were kids who could not even write, some of them, but yet they spoke, and they even asked what their authority was, and they quoted Joel chapter 2 and so on. So not only do we have physical events taking place, but we not only do we sort of relate this to physical things that took place, but we also have historical evidence of God actually intervening. And interestingly enough, because of these, the preaching of the child preachers of Sweden, 17 distillers closed their business because of the preaching of the child preachers. I get ahead of myself because it's exciting study.
Yes, yes.
But he says again, Philadelphia, because thou hast kept my word of patience, I will keep thee from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon the whole world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Again, here you have the idea that no one else was aware that Jesus was moving into the holier part of the temple. But behold, I come quickly, hold fast which thou hast, that no man can take thy crown. Him that overcometh, I will make a pillar in my temple, which is the new Jerusalem, which cometh out of heaven from God, and I will write on him my new name. But here's an interesting part. Verses 9 talks about, again, the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship before thy feet, and to know that I have loved thee. And from thence is then born an interesting movement, which existed from then till the very end of where we find ourselves now, which basically leads us to the last church. If I can go into that, leader,
before
if that's okay with you.
Before we go into that, Mdala, there are some questions here on WhatsApp.
Oh, yes.
Yes. One person says, what is the opposite of lifeless formalism? That's on WhatsApp. The person didn't tell us his or her name.
Yeah. So the opposite of lifeless formalism is a religion based on excitement and feeling. So you have lifeless form, you have an over excitement. So it's also almost like these religious awakenings of today, where it's all about, you know, do his will, God, you know, and in that sense, the holiness and it sort of dies away, but it's more pleasure more than anything else.
Is that the opposite of lifeless formalism?
Yeah, the very opposite of it. It's very opposite. I think it's very tricky to sort of create an opposite, because we are moving through different stages. So you'll have a lifeless formalism, then you'll have formalism, and then you have the middle ground, which is where we need to be. And then from there, you have, you know, a conservative approach and a very conservative approach. So,
all right.
Yeah, it could be many stages. In
between. No problem. Yeah. And then there is it Lullabelle or Lulubell? Bell. Lulubelle or Lullabelle Bell writes, God did experience the consequences of sin. He died on the cross. That was a consequence of sin. He may not have committed sin, but it does not mean he was not tempted in all points as we are, yet without falling to sin. He experienced sin. Yeah. He lived on earth, but he did not succumb to it.
Yes. Power. Powerful. No objection to that at all.
Okay. All right. Let's then go back to what is written here. From verse 9, which I was hoping you're going to touch on. You spoke about it, but you did not explain it. I will make those who are of the synagogue of Satan. Who are those again?
Hey! Yeah. And here it's where it becomes very tricky. And I'm going to be honest with you, it's a very lengthy study. The Church of Philadelphia contains some very interesting nuggets. The other part where we find the verse before talks about the open. In fact, when it introduces the church, it says, these things said he that is true, he that hath the key of David, he that openeth and no man shutteth, and shutteth that no man can open it. So we have the idea of two doors here. And by the way, we're not going to go extensively into this. I hope we get time to spend some time on it later when we talk about those who were left outside the door and those who managed to go with Christ symbolically into the other door. So there's the door closed and some are left behind it. Those who have denied the fact that they should look forward to a Christ who walks into the most holy place. And there the Bible almost presents an idea that there were those who were symbolically left behind as the others symbolically moved with Jesus through the open door. And it could be very complex to go into that right now.
But my question is on those who are in the synagogue of Satan, who are claiming to be Jews, and yet they're not.
Yes.
Who are those?
And I'm coming right there. When you look at the contrast between the ones God is praising, or the Millerites, the movement at that time that arises, seeing Jesus coming around 1844, you have the opposite of that, who are not even interested about the message of reformation, revival and reformation, and the fact that Jesus is about to come, the message of judgment, Revelation 14, verses 6. I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come. And again, so if you're aware of that judgment which has come, you want to move in the direction where God wants to take you. But those who then remain behind typically then are typified as the synagogue of Satan, who do not move with those who are aware of what's taking place in the heavenly sanctuary.
All right.
It could be a long debate.
Okay. Let's take a call for you. The person who is the same person who sent a message has just called. All right. Good afternoon to you. Welcome. You're live. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Ashley here. I'm back.
Yes, Ashley, go ahead.
Just another question on this synagogue of Satan that my elder is explaining now. There is a school of thought that those that died under the faith of the three angels' message, so beyond the open door, as articulated in early writings, that believed in this three angels' message, that this is a group of people that is going to awaken, or rather be resurrected, before what we now know as the second coming of Jesus Christ. There's going to be like a special resurrection that will take place, and that the purpose of this synagogue of Satan thing is to sort of like embarrass those that did not believe in the three angels' message. And I just want to hear what my elder thinks about that, because now the question that the host is asking is that who are these that are being said are of the synagogue of Satan? And that school of thought says that anybody that did not believe in the three angels' message or mocked it or persecuted those that believed in it, that person belongs to the synagogue of Satan. And there will be a special resurrection before the one that we know as the resurrection of the saints, which will only be aimed at embarrassing those that mocked the believers of the three angels' message. Is there any merit to that, Elder Jolly? And what is your thought on this school of thought?
Okay.
All right. Before Elder Jolly just responds there, just clarify for us, Ashley, where did you get that school of thought? Where is the school of thought?
It is a prominent school of
Ashley. We cannot hear
various
you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Go ahead, sir.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, much better, much better. So Go ahead, sir.
It's a prominent school of thought that is taught by many scholars, and if I could think of a prominent scholar that within the Adventist faith who also holds the same views, I think Pastor Stephen Bohr has done seminars on this, and then we could speak of I think there were some prominent writers. Is it the End Time book that has this, and perhaps Orion Smith as well? I'm not too sure. In his Daniel and Revelation book also says something similar.
Okay. All right, go ahead, Eldam Jolie.
Okay, maybe we're gonna sort of close on it, and we won't go into much detail into it. Yes, I want to throw an interesting verse based on what he's saying, which will basically lay the foundation of a future discussion we will have, particularly around this.
Right.
But if you go to Revelation 14, we know Revelation 14 from verses 6 up until 12 deals with the three angels' messages. Now, walk with me very carefully. I want you to walk with me. It deals with the three angels' messages. Verses 12 then says, here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. Almost identifying these people who will be doing the preaching. Then verse 13, is almost lingering around what Ashley just asked about. Although it's outside of the lesson, but I'm going to note it anyway so that we pick up the discussion later. It then says, very carefully, verse 13, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Not those who died before, but after the preaching of these three angels' messages, it's very clear in its description. It says, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth.
Right.
Yes, said the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works do follow them. So there is a special blessing that speaks to a special group of people, particularly at a time at the finishing of these three angels' messages. And it says, blessed are they that die in the Lord from henceforth. And by the way, it's a text we normally read in the funerals, but from the concept of where we find it or where the place where we find it, it may not necessarily relate to everyone. But again, so next week we will most probably go into the book of Laodicea. There's a lot to speak about the church of Laodicea. And again, thank you everyone for joining us. Yes, back to you, sir.
I don't know if you were agreeing with what Ashley was saying. Are those in the synagogue of Satan? He gave a description which he alleges is followed by a school of thinkers there. So do you agree with that?
I agree with the concept of a special resurrection. It's not the first one either. We will be seeing at Jesus' death, there were those who were raised. If you read the book of Matthew 27 and so on, they were raised at Jesus' death on the cross. Graves were open, but they did not go out of their graves up until Jesus then was raised on the Sunday morning. So there's a special resurrection that transpired there. There will be a special resurrection very closer to the second coming of Jesus. But again, maybe to linger on his point, Revelation 1, verses 7, just to show Revelation 1, I guess the verses 7, just to close it off on that particular point. So if you're asking whether I agree, I agree. It's just how it was put together. I think how he said it, maybe not necessarily fully, but he says, verse 7, behold, I come with the clouds, and every eye shall see him, and they also which pierced him, and all kingdoms in the earth shall wave because of him. Even so come, Lord, amen. So again, here he comes with the clouds. The time when Jesus comes with the clouds is the second advent. And you remember there are three comings of Christ. There's the first one when he came in and he was a baby. Then the next one is when he comes with the clouds, we see him. Then the last one is when we come down with the New Jerusalem after 1,000 years. So if he says he's coming with the clouds, how is it that some of those who pierced him will also see him? So it's a very interesting question, which will give way to when we get to the study of the special resurrection.
Perhaps when we begin our program next on Wednesday. We must start right here. Who are those who are in the synagogue of Satan?
So ideally, in principle, I do agree with Ashley, and we'll pick it up again next time.
Wednesday. Okay. So our first question on Wednesday is, who are those who are in the synagogue of Satan? I'm just emphasizing this, Elder, so that we know that's our first question when we begin our program next on Wednesday. Is that okay?
That's fine.
All right. Thank you very much, Abdal. Appreciate it. All right, that's how we end our program for today. Thank you very much for tuning in. You've been listening to yet another edition of Unlocking Bible Prophecy, and hopefully you'll be able to understand these things that are very complex, as you may have noticed from me, Nayodo Pondwana, and the team. Have a wonderful day, and Godspeed.
You are tuned into Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.